The last talk this morning will be by David Cimadoni, and he will speak about the lives and ask about hope.
I will start with simply stating the problem. It will be interesting then. So that the aim is to compute the easing partition function function. So that is, so we fix gamma a finite graph, with edge weights, that I will do like this. And the aim is to compute.
No, no, please. Move to the other.
Oh, already, okay. Compute what I would like to denote like this. So, G, depending on G in weights. This would be a sum over some kind of some subgraphs of G. So, and then the weight of all the product of all the weights gives the subgraph. And which subgraphs are we going to take here? We take simply so what physicists call contour, what François just called curves. What one might call simply one cycle modulo 2. That is, we consider all the subgraphs such that for any vertex V of the original graph, V is adjacent to an even number of edges. Okay? So this one can see really is mod 2 run cycles. So here I want to sum over all these.
Odd.
And you see,
V is adjacent to an odd number of edges.
No, to an even.
Oh, even, sorry,
yes. Okay. And so you see that this is exactly what François denoted by P, that would be PG, right? So these variables were y's, here it's our x, but that's exactly the same polynomial. So I didn't know about this relation, I just learned that. So the question is compute this. So if you're just interested in combinatorics, it's a relevant question to ask yourself. Okay, for example, if you set all the weights to be equal to 1, you just count all these even subgraphs. That's a question. If you're into statistical mechanics, it is actually a fundamental question for the easing model. Try to compute the partition function. Because in statistical mechanics, when you're able to compute this, well, you can then solve some problem, compute some other quantities associated to the model. So this is problem we'll try to address. And basically my aim in this talk is to show you that some things, some tools that we have in low-dimensional topology, such as sphinx structures, some basic algebraic topology tools can help to solve this kind of problems. It's not an obvious fact. Okay, so that's the statement of the problem. I would like to start with a small and not exhaustive history. So my history would start in with Lars von Zagera. In 44, he solved the problem for the square lattice, so explicit closed formula. I'll just take one more line. For the case of the square lattice of arbitrary size nm, and with two weights, so one weight on horizontal edges, let's say, and one weight on vertical edges. So that's then you get a function of x and y, and he gets an explicit formula for this function. Okay. But his method was extremely complicated, so-called algebraic method was very complicated. And so people started thinking about a more combinatorial method to get the same result. And that's where Cass and Ward, 1952, and they suggest the following method. So let this deal with the oriented edges. And they form the following matrix. So the indices are given by the oriented edges, and you get alpha times xe if something and zero else. This is very mysterious. So here they get some alpha, which is the following angle. So if the first oriented edge e finishes where the second oriented edge e prime starts, then you can measure some angle here, alpha. Okay, you take it between minus pi and pi. And they take the weight of the first edge and they multiply by this complex number given by this alpha. So quite amazing. And what do they, I mean, right now it's not amazing, it's just a definition, but here is what they state. Then, the determinant of this matrix is equal to V is in function of the weighted graph square. And this is what I like to call the cat square. So actually, they didn't prove any. So this formula makes sense whenever you have a planar graph with straight edges. Okay? Everything here makes sense whenever you have a planar graph with straight edges. What they did is that they knew what the result they wanted to have was, knowing on Zagera. So they cooked up some matrix whose determinant would give them what they want. And this is what they found. They didn't prove anything.
So it used to be x and y here.
So what they did was, so it was stated only for the case of the square lattice with x and y. It was not stated in a more general setting, like here, for any two ways. It was proved for none. And now let me just point out some remarkable property. I mean, something remarkable about this formula is that you see the right-hand side here is this associated to the abstract graph, weighted graph. While here, it definitely seems to depend on the way you have embedded your planar graph with straight edges. Well, another remarkable property, this is not obviously a square of a polynomial. Well, it should be. But again, no proof. And then what happened was in the 60s, early 60s, Hurst Green, Castellane, and Fischer, that was early 60s, they devised the first rigorous combinatorial derivation of the result of Gonzaga. So first, rigorous combinatorial treatment. And it was given, well, first only in the case of the square lattice and then for any planar graphs. Then any G plane. And their idea was the following. So the idea was the following. First, they want to change the graph. So you start with your graph, and again, I want to thank also your guys for making me speak right after François, because I have a feeling that I'm doing the same talk with words in the other order. All the words that he said are going to come. So here, to G, we have another graph that I will denote by gamma G. And basically, you did exactly what he was writing over there. So something like, in the case of trivalent, you do something like this. I will not go into the details, but you can somehow blow up all the vertices in some way. You get a much more more complicated graph. And then what you remark is that you make this correspondence such that if you want to compute the easing inflection function on your first graph, well, this is the same as the dimer inflection function on the associated graph if you choose, well, pure weights. This means if you're able to compute well enough to solve this dimer model, then you can solve the easing model. And the second part is, of course, then try to solve the dimer model. And then you solve it by, you can compute this partial function as a Pfaffian, as François was saying, of some matrix. Then you're happy. Why are you happy? Why am I happy each time I have a determinative fraction? Well, because then it means that you have a polynomial time algorithm to actually compute your function, which is a priori not clear at all when you look at the combinatorial problem. Absolutely not clear that you might be able to find a polynomial time algorithm. If you have a determinant, then you do. And then the last part of my short history. Five Russian authors in, I think, 1999. They gave the first rigorous proof, complete proof, of the Katzward formula. This for any planar graph with straight edges. So as I was mentioning earlier, this statement here makes sense in any planar graph with straight edges. And actually they proved the formula in this case.
Is there any Berezin integral? Do you know what I'm... am I in the right language?
So you mean, is it the same as Grassmann integral?
Yes.
So then there are, yeah.
And is this their proof?
No. I can... No, I cannot tell you much about it. I know it's really to grasp my table, but the proof is definitely going through this. I can. It's difficult for me now to tell you a bit about their proof, but it's definitely not going through this. I can maybe at the end I will try to say a couple of words about it. Okay, so that's the end of my history. And so now I want to come to the generalized. That's what for me. So here, as I was saying at the beginning, the aim is to actually extend this to any finite graph. Not thing, not straight edges, nothing. And clearly this is not obvious, because how would you possibly make sense of such a thing, an angle alpha here, if your graph is not planar, or if your edges are not straight? So you, the finite graph embeds in a surface, but then how can you count rotations or winding numbers? Again, another ingredient that was thought. How can you count these things on a surface? Well, actually, there is an object, a geometric object, that does exactly this. It's called a spin structure. So maybe I'll just recall briefly what a spin structure is in a kind of informal way. Recall that a spin structure on a closed oriented surface sigma is what? So there is a definition in terms of cohomology class of the frame bundle of the manifold, but it's a little bit you can see what it means really. But really what this means, the spin structure, is the following thing. Is a map. Let's call it lambda. That has values in Z2 and associates an integer modulo 2 to any closed curve gamma on the surface with a tangent vector field. So a framed curve. The tangent, well, say non-vanishing tangent vector field. So basically the aim of this lambda is to somehow count winding numbers or rotation numbers. And here you want to do this, of course, such that whenever you have lambda of the boundary of a small disk with the framing, the restriction of a constant framing, you want this to come zero, obviously. This is definitely the best example of what you would like to be zero. And lambda of this, oh yeah, and definitely you would want this to count one. Right. Okay. Now the question is, how can one give oneself a spin structure on the surface? So there is a standard way. Lambda can be given, for example, by a vector field on the surface with zeros of even index.
Excuse me, you didn't give the complete definition of the spin structure.
Well, no, I didn't give the complete definition, but this actually amounts to it. So what are you expecting on top of that?
So you want this to be at least a cocycle on this frame.
So really a spin structure, you have the frame bundle on the surface, and then the spin structure is an element here, such that the restriction, so let's say lambda here, the restriction of lambda to the fiber is the non-trivial element. And so this being a co-cycle is exactly this, and the restriction to the fiber being not really exactly this.
You need some
linearity.
Yes, indeed. So you have some linearity here. So again, I'm not. This is not a correct mathematical definition, but it's the idea of what you want first in structure, right? Does such a spin, a vector field give a spin structure? Well, when you have X a vector field, you can ask it to its this lambda X is given by the following formula: lambda X of your framed curve. What will you take? You will take simply the winding number of the vector field y with respect to the vector field x, and you take this modulo 2. I'm just looking for the 1.
The right.
Yes, that's it. So you see, you have a fixed vector field x. And then you simply go along your curve, and you simply count with respect to this framing, given framing vector field. Take it as a reference. You count the number of turns that the other vector field. Okay. Okay. I need to give you a couple of facts. So some facts. Structures. First fact, well, the set of spin structures. So again, here I was not very precise, you have to take some equivalence class, but I will not go into this. But the set of spin structures is an affine H upper 1 sigma z2 space. So it admits a freely transitive action of this ability. So in particular, the number of spin structures is given to by 2 to the power 2g. Second fact, and here again I'm not going to go into details, but spin structures come in two flavors, two classes, spin structures. The ones, the even ones and the odd ones, the ones that have so-called ARF invariant 0 or ARF invariant 1. And, okay, again, I will not go into this, but that's a fact, they split into classes. Okay, I think I am done with all the preliminaries. Let me see, geometric preliminaries for my formula. So again, let's come back to what we're interested in. We have this graph. So G is a finite graph with n weights. Okay, first thing, you embed it in a closed oriented surface. Embed G in a closed oriented surface sigma, and well, perhaps I will want this supposed to be smooth and look at the Riemannian metric. That's important. Okay. Then you fix one spin structure on the surface, and again I want this to think of this as one way to count rotation numbers. And I want this to be given by some vector field with zeros of even index in the complements of the graph. Okay? And finally, I fix one point in each edge. Okay, so with all this, I will define what I will call a generalized scaffold matrix. I will multiply by 1 minus t lambda. Switch next word. What the definition? Okay, so I need to define this T lambda G, so where T lambda G is given by some coefficients. Again, EE prime are in the set of oriented edges of the graph, and they're defined as follows. So EE prime is equal to, first case, again, you have that the end of the first edge is the beginning of the next one. Second case, well, it's zero else. And something I now notice that I forgot in the first definition is that here you want this, but you want e prime not to be equal to minus e. Okay, and that's indeed, even in the classical case, it would not have made sense if we were going the way around, then the square root is not well defined. So, okay, in this case, we have some first edge e. If it ends at the beginning of e prime, but e prime is not minus e, then we have something and zero else. What is this something? This is exponential I over 2 alpha lambda of e prime time xe. So you recognize the usual Capsule matrix, but I have, of course, to tell you, and everything is here, what is this angle alpha, how do you count it? Well, now we have just put everything so that we can count such an angle, where alpha lambda of e prime is the rotation number of the velocity vector field along, well, first e and then e prime with respect to the vector field giving lambda. From the fixed point in e to the fixed point in e prime. To the one in e prime. Here, when you have the angle, well, you count it exactly as the defect angle, exactly as in the cat square formula. So you have your fixed vector field. Okay, you start, you follow your first edge, you count, you have a rotation number. Then you arrive at the angle, then you count also this angle, then you continue.
In the orientation of the surface, because you could jump in two ways. Yeah?
Yes, you're right. Yes.
Okay.
this matrix seems to be an odd object to look at because it does depend on many things that were not in our original statement. So it depends on the spin structure, that's normal, but it also depends on the on the choice of the vector field representing this spin structure. It depends on the choice of these points in the middle of each edge. So that seems to be a weird matrix. Well, the fact is that the determinant does not depend on all this. Furthermore, so now I can state it here. So, the determinant is the square of a polynomial in the variable xp's. I should start by saying for any fixed spin structure, sorry about that, the determinant is the square of polynomial in the xp's, which only depends on the weighted graph embedded in the surface and on the spin structure. Furthermore, you have what I call the generalized transfer formula. The easing correction function of the weighted graph is given by 1 over 2 to the power of g. So Ponsoir thought it was 2g, but actually it's g, so it's exactly the same. It's complete analog to what he was describing 1 hour ago. Sum over all the spin structures minus 1 to the power of the arf invariant of the spin structure times the determinant of the matrix 1/2, the square root of the determinant. Which square root do I take? Well, you see that if you set all the weights to be equal to 0, then you get the identity matrix. So it means that this polynomial has a constant constant coefficient, which is 1. So you take the square root with constant coefficient plus 1. That's the formula. So you see, it doesn't mean... So what does it mean? It means that if you have a fixed genus, then you can compute these things in polynomial time. Of course, it's not true that then you can compute in polynomial time for any graph. For example, if you take the cubical graph, it's one of the big open questions in the theory, trying to compute the easing correction function for the cubical graph of arbitrary size. But you see that if you do this, if you try to embed a cubical graph in a surface, the genus of the surface will explode, and therefore the number of determinants you have to compute will explode. Okay. But if you have, for example, graphs that approximate more and more a torus or a genus to surface, then you can apply this formula. Okay, so I want to continue with some examples. And how much time do I have? Half an hour. I have half an hour more.
15.
15. I was wondering if I would say this. Okay, good. Where's my view? Okay, so examples. The first example I want to show is simply to motivate the fact that it's indeed a generalized Catford formula. So, if you take G planar, and I'm given with straight edges. Okay, so in the plane you have a unique spin structure. Okay, a unique way to count rotation numbers. And there is a, kind of a natural representative for this. It's a constant vector field. So, is only one spin structure, and this spin structure can be represented by a constant vector field. Okay? And so you see that when you try to compute this alpha lambda of E prime, what you really compute is only this jump here. And so what you have is exactly the alpha that we had in the usual network formula. And therefore, you see that this unique generalized Cotswold matrix is nothing but what we had at the beginning, the standard Cotswold matrix. And OK, then you look at this sum. You have, of course, G equals 0. You have sum over a single one. It turns out the alpha invariant is here is 0. And so you get that this is the square root which is exactly the standard one for me. Hence the name.
Is there an expectation either way for the general computable graph?
So I'm almost sure it's known to be an NP-complete problem. So it's not expected to be, it's not expected that one can compute it effectively, the same way one does.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Can you see the decomposition according to spin structure at the level of the partition function?
No, because you see at the level of partition function, that's a good question because it relates to what I wanted to say. So at the level of the partition function, again, this side here is just associated to the graph, to an abstract graph. And here to the right, it seems to depend on the way you will embed in the surface. And actually, seems to depend even on which surface you will choose, because definitely even a planar graph you can embed in the torus. And according to this formula, you count twice the thing, you should get the same thing. This is maybe the most striking part of this formula, is that actually this thing to the right seems to depend so much on the way the graph is embedded in the surface, while the part to the left is not. And I will give an explicit example now.
So you allow a non-minimum data to be slightly.
Yes, of course. Any embedding. So let me give you an example here, which answers all these questions. So that is the first example. Here's the second example. So let's take G be this graph. Okay? So it's a graph, let's put X as weight. What is the Easing partition function? So of course here one does not need such a technology to compute it, right? You have the empty subgraph and you have the full subgraph. You have 1 plus x. Now let's just do it as a reality check. We'll try to check this formula on this example using two embeddings on the graph. Once in the plane, as anybody would want to do, and then we'll embed in the torus, and you will see that we get the same thing. Okay. So first part. We take simply G and embed in the plane. Okay, so I fix one point, let's say this one, the edge. I call E this oriented edge here. And of course I choose this, the unique spin structure represented by this. And now let's compute these angles. So alpha lambda of E. So the entries of the matrix minus E will be 0. By what I said in definition. So we'll have only two angles to compute, EE and minus E minus E. So EE, we start with this, we go around here, we continue, and we just make a full turn. Okay, so here let's say we have, in this case it would be minus 2P. minus E minus E. Here we have plus 2 pi, just go the other way around. Okay, so then let's compute the our determinant. So we have the determinant of 1 minus something, so we have zeros of diagonal, 1 minus something. The something you want here is an x, but then you still have this e to the power I over 2 times this angle, which means a minus sign, right? So here I have minus x squared, so it works. Okay? It's kind of funny to observe that even this completely trivial example is not encompassed in the classical Casper matrix because it doesn't have straight edges. Again, it's not such an achievement, but at least it works. Okay. An embedding of the graph in the torus. So now let's embed the graph as follows. Okay? That's an embedding of the graph in the oriented surface. That's fine. So this, I want to draw it like this. Let's call A this side, B, so this loop, B this loop, and I want to okay. Good. So now this time it's a little bit more clean. We have four spin structures. There is one that is not strong, is the you take the constant vector field on the plane, it induces a constant vector field on the torus. So let's call this lambda 1, 1. So it's just constant vector fields. And now let's take lambda, I will call lambda minus 1, 1, respectively lambda 1, minus 1, lambda minus 1, minus 1, obtain from the constant 1, lambda 1, 1, by a full twist, along the cycle A, respectively along B, respectively along A and B. So now I have, since I didn't define the Arf invariance there, I cannot make these computations, but it's very easy to see that actually the set of spin structures on the torus is represented by these four vector fields. So it's exactly these lambda, epsilon 1, epsilon 2. And it's a fact that the Arf invariant of lambda epsilon 1 epsilon 2 is equal to, so it's an odd one if epsilon 1 equals epsilon 2 equals plus 1, the constant one, and 0 otherwise. So let's try to compute our angles again, our rotation number, I don't know how to call them. So, alpha lambda 1 1 of EE. Well, you see, the vector field is constant, you go straight through it, it's zero. You have strictly nothing. Okay? So, here actually I will write zero. If I will write the general formula, epsilon 1, epsilon 2. So it's 0 if epsilon 1 is equal to 1, and it's 2 pi plus or minus 2 pi else. You see, the only way you can get the rotation is if you make this full twist along A, that's why I called epsilon 1 equals minus 1. OK, Okay, and it's the same for plus or minus. And it's the same for minus e minus e. And so let's make our summation now. So, well, let's compute the determinant first. So the determinant of I minus t lambda epsilon 1 epsilon 2 of g is equal to what? So it's 1 minus something, determinant, 0, 0. And here you get epsilon 1 times x. You see, if epsilon 1 is plus 1, then you have no signs coming from the angles, and you have the minus sign. If epsilon 1 is minus 1, you have a sign coming in, so that's it. So if you look at the square root of the determinant of this, you get 1 minus epsilon 1 s. Okay?
So don't, I'm slightly confused.
Yes.
If you rotate your vector field along a curve B, it seems that you don't change the vector field.
So also, what I mean here, rotate, maybe that's not so clear. So you have this vector field like this.
Yes.
And then you change it by simply, so whenever you, yeah, so maybe just not to explain, whenever you cross it, you make a full twist. You start like this, then you move like this.
Ah, okay.
You see?
Yeah, yeah.
So that you're right, you're not very well done.
And there is also another direction when you, when A looks like that, then along E you do not have any rotation.
So you see, if you don't change A here, you will not have any rotation along E. You agree? So you see, I only change things here in the neighborhood of A. Okay, so I make this rotation here in the neighborhood of A. So that whenever I have changed this along A, I have a full twist coming in along E. And if I change something along the neighborhood B, what I call epsilon 2, I will not change anything. Okay. And so now, let's try to compute this sum that we have here. So z of gx is 1/2 times what? So I have, first I have a minus 1 times 1 minus x. Then I have 3 plus 1s. One of them is 1 minus x, and two others are 1 plus x. And you see that two of them will cancel, divided by 2, and you get the right result. So I have 2 minutes, I guess. How many do you have?
17.
No, okay, anyway, I'm basically done, so. So, also, I'll just really say 2 words. Two words about the ideas that are involved. So actually, I have 2 proofs of this formula. So, 2 proofs. The first one is a combinatorial proof. So actually, what I'm doing is that I'm using a result by Johnson, so the same Dennis Johnson that appears in this back in class 2 story, using Johnson's theorem, which relates the spin structures on a surface with quadratic forms on the H1 surface. Quadratic forms. That's a standard result, and this is the way you define the arc invariant actually. So you have a spin structure, you have an associated quadratic form, then this has an arc invariant, and this is how you look. Okay, so basically what happens is that once you have the right objects defined, that is, these generalized Casper matrices using these spin structures, And once you know about this Johnson theorem, well, you can actually boil down this formula to some difficult combinatorial questions. But the five Russians that I was, Dolbinin and co-authors that I was quoting, actually did all the work for this. So actually, once you have defined the right objects and you know the Johnson theorem, all the homological problems are actually solved. And then you boil down to local problems that actually were already solved. So it's Johnson theorem plus Dolbinin. And I just want to say two words about the second proof, that actually this trick that I was mentioning of looking at an associated dimer model works in an arbitrary genus. So this is the Fischer-Castellain trick. So you take your graph, you look at an associated graph that will live on the same surface, and then you can try to solve the dimer model on this, the dimer model on this associated graph. And it turns out that, well, Veshatikin and myself have a theorem for this, the dimer model, the graph, and the formula is strictly, is exactly the same. And so then it actually boils down to understanding that if you want to, the determinant of these matrices is the same as the Pfaffian of the associated matrices. And once you are, you know this link, then not only you have a second proof of the of this formula, but it gives a link between these two methods, combinatorial methods, that were thought to be completely different. The Katzwart method and the Castellain-Fisher method. And I think I will stop here.
Is there a lower bound for the genus of a surface in which you can embed the cubic graph?
Oh, so this I don't know, but you see, when I say cubic graph, it means of size M and L. And I'm sure they have devised some bound, but what is clear is that this bound explodes as M, N, and L go higher. And so what people are interested in physics is actually to have some kind of asymptotic formula. So one, is it, once you have a closed formula of this type, you want to know what happens when you make your graph finer and finer, and try to, if you normalize this, you want to have some, I mean, the free energy, right, these kind of things. And this, you will never get for the cubic graph using this, because you don't have a closed formula. So you don't have a closed formula as the number of, as the sum will explode. And so it's not good for this.
Is there a conceptual explanation for the appearance of the half invariant? If you think of the half invariant as specifying the spin covertism group?
Yes, so...
Or it's just...
No, at this I don't know. So think about... No. I mean, the explanations of the appearance of the half invariant here is kind of a stupid algebraic lemma that tells you that basically this is... Well, no, so I simply don't know the answer to your question. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know. I mean, I should say it's quite... I mean, I was extremely happy when I saw that this formula was coming up, because if you actually compute the things, the sign here, it might seem to be a very, very complicated thing. And then when you have this formula coming out, where actually this is a well-known invariant of the spin structure, and basically you think the formula could not be nicer. But to your question, I don't have an answer.
Is it somehow related to... I remember that you had a paper about combinatorial definition, combinatorial representation of spin structures and
so on. Yes, exactly. So it's very related to this. So actually, this is what lies at the core of this second proof here. So when you make a sum, when you study the dimer model, your sum is not over spin structures; it's over so-called Castellain orientations. And then when I say that this determinant is the same as the Pfaffian of the, well, you have to understand which matrix here corresponds to which matrix on the other side. You have 2 to the power of g, 2g matrix on each side. And this correspondence is actually exactly what you're mentioning. It's the fact that Castellain orientations are so-called discrete spin structures. You have a natural relation between them, which makes the whole thing work very nice. And this is really the reason why people were not able to understand that these two methods are linked. It's because you need to go in a more topological setting to understand that, okay, what is really going on is skin structure, even in the catchword case where people thought, okay, it's only with straight edges and so on. And once you're in this kind of more topological setting, everything becomes extremely clear. So it's really the whole, the dictionary between the two matrices is very nice. So it's, the whole thing is completely canonical.
What do you expect, Father, things similar to that, not for spin structure, but for this when you have trivialization Z and over Z and not over Z to the same
So I have to say, I did try to do other kind of, so here the basic trick, I mean, the thing that makes everything work is that you have these object Cassian orientations. They are discrete versions of spin structures. On spin structures, you know this theorem. And then you can work with this geometry to have all the combinatorics you want without making your hands dirty. And so I did try some other things, not spin structures, but spin C structures. And so Gwenaël, for example, has some kind of analog of the Johnson theorem or something. And I did try a little bit. But there are many, many miracles hidden here. That, and each time I tried something, one of the miracles were not occurring. Yeah. So, I don't.
Other questions?